This is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. There is an air of expectancy here in Washington with opening arguments in the Senate impeachment trial of U.S. President Donald Trump on the near horizon. That's scheduled for Tuesday. Meanwhile, Democrats continue their efforts to get Senate Republicans to accept their demands for trial witnesses and documents so far withheld. We get a report from AP correspondent Tim McGuire.
The increased demands by Democrats follow one of Rudy Giuliani's indicted associates, Lev Parnas, telling House investigators that former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, was under some kind of surveillance when she was still in Kiev. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo tells WIBC Radio in Indianapolis.
I've not met this guy, Lev Parnas, to the best of my knowledge. I've never encountered, never communicated with him.
He adds that the State Department will investigate the allegations.
I suspect that much of what's been reported will ultimately prove wrong.
Documents provided by Parnas also suggest there may have been a threat to Yovanovitch shortly before she was abruptly recalled last spring. Tim McGuire, Washington.
A controversial gun rights rally is set for Monday in Richmond, Virginia. There are major concerns about the potential for violence. Virginia's highest court has upheld a temporary ban on firearms at the rally site on the grounds of the state capitol. Pro-gun groups are upset. Here's AP's Mike Gracia.
Gun rights groups challenging an executive order issued by Virginia Governor Ralph Northam have lost their case before the Virginia Supreme Court. The gun proponents wanted to overturn an executive order issued by Northam on Wednesday, banning guns on the Capitol grounds at an annual gun rights rally next Monday. Northam cited credible threats in issuing the order and declaring a state of emergency. Concurrently, the FBI announced the arrest of six men linked to a white supremacist group known as The Base. An official told the Associated Press at least three of them were planning to attend the rally in Richmond. I'm Mike Gracia.
Meanwhile, President Trump charges the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, is under very serious attack in Virginia. From Washington, this is VOA News. The World Health Organization reports there is no evidence of a human-to-human spread of the new coronavirus that sickened dozens of people, but that the Chinese infection still bears watching. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Investigations are continuing, aimed at identifying the source of the new coronavirus. Late last year, China reported a cluster of cases of pneumonia of unknown cause. Many were linked to a fish market in Wuhan, central China's largest city. The World Health Organization reports 41 people have been infected with the disease in China, including two deaths. Additionally, two infections have been identified in Thailand and one in Japan among people who had traveled to Wuhan. The spread of the disease outside of China is raising concern among health officials and the general public.
That was Lisa Schlein for VOA in Geneva. Boeing says it's working with the Federal Aviation Administration on a new software issue on the troubled 737 MAX 8 jets involved in two fatal crashes which killed nearly 400 people. Here's AP's Ed Donahue.
The problem is with the software powering up the 737 MAX. A person with knowledge of the situation tells the AP it's software that verifies whether monitors tracking key systems on the plane are working properly. The system is supposed to work automatically. Boeing is rewriting software that played a role in crashes 5 months apart in Indonesia and Ethiopia that killed 346 people. 737 MAX jets have been grounded for almost a year. Boeing said in a statement, "Our highest priority is ensuring the 737 MAX is safe and meets all regulatory requirements before it returns to service." I'm Ed Donahue.
The Trump administration wants to cut further into healthy school lunch requirements set by the Obama White House. It was a priority for former First Lady Michelle Obama. Here's AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
The National School Lunch Program serves about 30 million students, mostly from low-income families. Under the Obama administration, new guidelines required more fresh produce, whole grains, and lower levels of sodium, sugar, and fat. The Trump administration already lifted some of those requirements and now wants to reduce the amount of fresh produce served and allow students to buy foods like burgers, fries, and pizza a la carte. The proposals were announced on former First Lady Michelle Obama's birthday, and the head of her Let's Move campaign calls them a shameless, embarrassing capitulation to lobbyists at the expense of American children. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
More news at voanews.com. There is also a convenient, easy-to-use mobile app. Gene Randall, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
One cannot just openly say they're reconciled, but the he just read and accepted the committee, which is really be part of it.
The Lesotho Prime Minister plans to retire after calling for peace and reconciliation among leaders in the ruling party.
Ali Bongo is absolutely unable to hold a joint press conference with the heads of state who can do it besides. Important events have been taking place in Gabon without himself.
A prominent Gabonese opposition leader expresses concern about human rights abuses in the country.
Now I know I have less than 48 hours, and their demand is for me and my colleagues in the Anti-Corruption Bureau to reveal the names of the suspects, arrest them, and prosecute them. So you can see the challenge that is before us.
And the Malawian Anti-Corruption Bureau launches investigation into attempts to bribe judges who will soon rule over the challenge to the outcome of the presidential election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A faction of the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Convention, or ABC, has welcomed as a positive development a reconciliation call by Prime Minister Dr. Thomas Tabani to unite the group. According to Max Moswecha, the spokesperson for the ABC faction led by Professor Nkosa Mahau, the call is a major step to unite the party. This after the Prime Minister announced plans to step down next week. Spokesperson Max Moswecha tells me there's need for a confidence-building measure among the factions in an effort to unite the party.
His speech was welcomed and appreciated by the members of the ABC, although because of the background to which we come from, there are still perceptions and mistrust, but we think as time goes on, we will get to be used to each other. Now, both factions were there, and I think they were happy to see us together with the leader and to take the mandate of theirs forward since we have been elected, although we have been wasting our time of the internal strife that took us to court in and out all the time. But as of now, the people are thinking of the way forward of which we have to formulate the program that will have to cover all the time that we have been spending in the cause without doing what we have been elected for. But in relation to the Prime Minister and the leader speech, we got a reconciliation and the unity, and they thanked us for, even though we have been two factions, no one wanted to leave the party. We have come back united as previously, but the problem is that the time has gone since we have been elected. Therefore, as of now, I think we have to sit down and formulate the program of the way forward.
Does that mean that there would have to be a period of reconciliation or confidence-building measure in order to unite the entire ABC factions as one body?
Yes, confidence building has to come for and be done by us in the leadership so that we can extend it to the membership, because those factions had their membership of the ABC behind them. Therefore, we must be seen to be really united, as we are saying, so that the membership down there, they have to be healed, and all the things which were said or done against each other, we have to do things that we have to make them to bypass them and to leave them behind.
Did the Prime Minister, in the interaction with the entire membership of the body, did the Prime Minister announce exactly when he plans to retire or resign?
He was not specific with the time, but he said when that time comes, he will have to inform the National Executive Committee, of which the NEC will have to plan his way and plan his way out and in the executive. And he only resigns as the Prime Minister of Lesotho, and he will remain the leader of the ABC.
Where does this leave the people of Lesotho as well as leadership of the ABC party?
No, actually, for the people of Lesotho being resigning from the government, they are still skeptical of who and what kind of a person will be appointed or nominated in parliament to become the leader, who will become the prime minister. Because now the leader has to be, or the prime minister has to be elected by the parliamentarians. Now it depends how, which people of the stature of the person that will have to be elected in the parliament to become the prime minister. The people will just only worry about that. But the one in the party, they don't care, because that matter will be handled by the party itself.
Did he also reconcile with Professor Mahao? You know, there was a disagreement within the ruling coalition or the senior partner of the coalition in the ABC. Did he reconcile with Professor Mahao?
No. Actually, we accepted what he said, including Professor Mahao himself. We accepted, but although there's never been any discussion on one-to-one or together with him in the ANC, because we have never sat down with him and discussed the matter of the party as the ANC with his inclusion. One cannot just openly say they're reconciled, but we just read and accepted the committee of which he really be part of it.
So will Professor Mahao be ready to have a one-on-one discussion with the Prime Minister as part of the reconciliation process?
Yes.
Max Masuecha is the spokesperson for the Lesotho ruling party, the All Basotho Convention, or ABC faction, led by Professor Nkosa Mahao. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Gabonese main opposition leader is expressing concern about the human rights situation in the Central African country. Jean Ping, a former prime minister and former chairperson of the African Union Commission, says there's need for the international community to step in to help resolve the political crisis. This after expressing concern that the government is not respecting the constitution, which calls for the respect for human rights, an accusation the government sharply denies. In part two and one of the interview with the Gabonese main opposition leader, Jean Ping tells me the international community should not ignore the human rights abuses in the country.
I would say that the human rights situation is very, very bad in Gabon. It is the consequence of the way the regime took over the power in August 2016. You may know that Mr. Ali Bongo imposed himself, therefore, he is able to govern only in permanent violation of human rights. Since 2016, the regime has systematically refused entry to human rights organizations. The regime can then operate with impunity and out of the sight of a very wide field, such as repression against peaceful demonstrations, arbitrary restrictions or blockages of internet arbitrary, or long-term arrest, as is the case for political prisoners detained in 2016 and 2017. Indeed, there is a massive violation of human rights in my country.
Do you think the presence of international human rights organizations to investigate these allegations of gross human rights violations could help in the respect of human rights in Gabon?
Well, of course, I think so. Because the Ali Bongo and the rest of the dictator, they think that they can, on behalf of what they call sovereignty, continue to kill out of the view of the rest of the world, to massacre in silence in a closed country.
How would you rate the state of the respect of human rights in Gabon currently?
Well, there is no respect of human rights as stated in the constitution. You should know that the 1991 Gabonese constitution, like any other constitution in the modern state, is based on the guarantee of rights and freedoms. More specifically, the 1991 constitution includes right and freedom through its provision and the text to which its preamble refers. Our constitution included into its preamble The Declaration of Human Rights and the Citizens' Rights of 1789 and the Universal Declaration of the Human Rights of 1948. Added to this is the African Charter of Human Rights and People's Rights of 1981 on one end, and the National Charter of Freedom of 1990 on the other end. Since we are not under the rule of law in Gabon, human rights are constantly, permanently violated. This is why one of the central themes of my political program is to protect the Gabonese people from fear.
Now, if I may ask you, supporters of the government have often expressed concern that your political party supporters, as well as other opposition party supporters, sometimes get unruly. They clash with the police, creating instability. Meanwhile, knowing very well that the police are mandated by the Constitution to enforce law and order in the country. How do you respond to these concerns by the ruling party supporters?
Well, first of all, the main issue in the context that has prevailed since 2016 is that of the coup d'etat and the stolen power that has imposed itself in blood. Ali Bongo Health is only one aspect that has been added to a complicated political situation due to the military electoral coup. Ali Bongo has a stroke in October 2018. He are facing a period of untruth and studying concerning the real state of Ali Bongo. Since August 2019, Ali Bongo's outstanding aiming to restore his image have rather revealed to the Gabonese people his real situation, his real state. Obviously, Ali Bongo is absolutely unable to rule the country. The regime uses all of the tricks to rule out any formal medical expert, but no one doubts his incapacity today. Ali Bongo is absolutely unable to hold a joint press conference with the heads of state who came to his side. Important events have been taking place in Gabon without himself. I can take the example of the so-called coup d'etat which occurred in January 9, 2019. No one can understand why he remains silent on such an event.
Jean Ping is the main Gabonese opposition leader and former chairperson for the African Union Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Libreville. The chairperson for the Malawian Anti-Corruption Bureau says the anti-graft agency has launched an investigation into allegations on attempted bribery of judges ruling over the outcome of the disputed presidential election. Renick Matemba also says he has officially received a letter from the Human Rights Defenders Coalition, or HRDC, a political pressure group demanding the anti-graft organization to swiftly act on the bribery allegation. ACB chairperson Renick Matemba tells me the Chief Justice officially petitioned the anti-graft agency about the attempted bribery, which he says led to the launch of the inquiry.
I received a letter from the Chief Justice of the Republic of Malawi. The letter was in the form of a complaint where he told me that he had been approached by judges that are hearing the presidential elections case. Of course, they finished hearing the case. The trial itself concluded. Now they are busy writing the judgment. So he relayed a complaint to me from the judges about an attempted bribe that was made on two of the judges. So that is what we're investigating at the moment.
Do you think this falls within the purview of the Anti-Corruption Bureau since this has national implications?
Yes, it falls within our mandate as Anti-Corruption Bureau, and that's exactly why the Chief Justice referred the matter to the Anti-Corruption Bureau for investigations. We have a wide mandate, corruption prevention, as well as law enforcement. So this particular issue, which was brought to my attention, falls under our law enforcement mandate, which is to investigate corrupt practices as well as prosecute corrupt offenses. So it falls within our mandate, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Some people have expressed concern and wondering when the investigation will be concluded, because the judges are expected to come up with their ruling within the next few weeks. So does that give you enough window to thoroughly investigate this?
Unfortunately, that is one of the things that I've been putting across, because even though I got the letter from the Chief Justice on the 8th of December, that's when he formally delivered the letter to me, because even though I had met him on the 28th of November, where we had a discussion over this, he said, Renick, you should wait until I formally complain. And the other challenge which I've tried to put across to the people of Malawi is that even though the Chief Justice gave the letter to me on the 8th of December, the judges were still sitting on the presidential elections case itself. And the understanding was that we should not disturb them from hearing the presidential case, which is very crucial. We should only get to them after they have finished recording evidence, in other words, conducting the trial. So we only started our investigations after we had managed to record statements from them, and that was on the 28th of December. We were also on holiday, on Christmas and New Year holidays. Public offices were closed. We opened on the 6th of January. So in other words, we have had less than 2 weeks of investigating this matter. I understand the anger from the people of Malawi, but I've been trying to plead with the people of Malawi to also understand the position in which we found ourselves. We are trying to balance the interests of the judges, the interests of the case itself, the presidential elections case, as well as the demand of the people of Malawi. It's a delicate balance, and it has proven to be quite tricky for me and my colleagues in the Anti-Corruption Bureau.
From the reaction that you've gotten from the people of Malawi, because they expect things to be expedited and the perpetrators brought to book, did you reassure them that there would be no political pressure leaned on the Anti-Corruption Bureau to do its work thoroughly and independently?
Yes, I think I tried. I did try to convince the listeners. I also accept the fact that the environment at the moment is quite tense. The emotions are high. Since we had the general elections in May last year, the country has been unstable. There have been demonstrations almost on a monthly basis. So you could even see the tempers, the emotions from the questions that were coming after the press briefing. So I think that's the situation in which we have found ourselves as an Anti-Corruption Bureau. I think the environment could have been different if the allegations that have been brought to our attention were not related with the presidential elections case, which on its own has been quite controversial. Emotions are high. So I understand, but I would only hope the people of Malawi who listen to what I said, who understand the environment in which we operate as ACB, but let me confess, it's becoming a bit of a problem to be able to investigate this matter without interruptions and interference.
So how do you plan on engaging them to meet what some people have described as high expectations for these perpetrators to be brought to book since this complaint has been made official?
Normally, we engage with the people of Malawi through the media. The elected representatives of the people of Malawi are members of parliament, but there are also some civil society organizations which equally and ably represent the people of Malawi. I've received a petition from one of the most influential civil society organizations in Malawi, the Human Rights Defenders Coalition. So they gave me a petition yesterday, and I've been given 72 hours from yesterday, including the weekend tomorrow. And I know they're counting. Now I know I have less than 48 hours. And their demand is for me and my colleagues in the Anti-Corruption Bureau to reveal the names of the suspects, arrest them, and prosecute them. So you can see the challenge that is before us.
Renick Matemba is the chairperson for the Malawian Anti-Corruption Bureau. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. A legal advisor to Libya's National Army, led by General Khalifa Haftar, has called on the U.S. to help bolster a ceasefire in an effort to bring peace and stability to the North African country. Eldin Abdul-Krim al-Shokri says without the involvement of the administration in Washington with the peace process, it would be difficult to maintain peace in Libya. His remarks come after General Haftar left Russia without signing a peace deal brokered by the international community. This, as General Haftar and Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj are expected in Germany this weekend for talks aimed to end the ongoing conflict in Libya. Eldin Abdul-Krim al-Shokri tells me he does not see Turkey as part of the solution to resolving the security challenges facing Libya.
It is reality without the U.S. involvement in this process, with all its leverage and put terrorist militias in Libya, in the fact that they have to be disarmed and dismantled and restore peace in Libya and begin a democratic process involved with all civilian population, men and women, to vote and choose their government and their parliament. It will never happen without the use of force by the Libyan forces, the Libyan National Army, to get rid of those militias. And without the involvement and pushing them to disarm and dismantled, it will never happen without a real battle on the field by the Libyan people and their national army. There would be no other solution.
What about the issue of Turkey? Why are you accusing Turkey of being part of the problem instead of the Turkey trying to bring about a solution and ceasefire in Libya?
Because the Americans know, and the international intelligence agencies know, that these terrorists are being brought from Syria and Iraq and Afghanistan through Turkey to Libya, to Misrata and to Tripoli. This is known fact, and we have all the evidence of that. And they brought weapons in front of all the world. The whole world is watching them. And they brought drones and specialists in using them in this against the Libyan National Army and against the Libyan people. And this is a fact. That's why we say Turkey and Erdogan is the main problem of Libya. Otherwise, this battle would have been solved a long time ago.
People are blaming Haftar for being part of the problem as well, because he refused to sign the deal despite Sarraj signing the deal.
Yes, because Sarraj wants the... Now he knows that if he doesn't find... Because he is only a puppet of Erdogan. Erdogan said to him, sign, he will sign, without looking to the best interests of the Libyan people. Now we are looking at the facts on the ground. If we do a ceasefire and have green lines, that means a partition of Tripoli to northern Tripoli controlled by the terrorists and southern Tripoli controlled by the National Libyan Army. We will never allow that. The only solution is to get rid of the militias that made all those crimes in Tripoli against the civilians that's in control of the government, in Sarraj's government.
What's next for the people of Libya? How do you bring peace to Libya? How do you take the ceasefire forward so the process could begin by ensuring that the peace returns to Libya?
We cannot trust any process. Turkey is part of it. No, we cannot trust it. We cannot be fooled.
So if you will not negotiate with terrorists, what do you do now? How do
We will uproot them out of Libya. Like the same way the United States would do if the terrorists, the American government, which is we see as a superpower, for us is a model, for me at least.
Does that mean that the fight or the conflict will continue?
Yes, till we get rid of those terrorists. If the solution does not include dismantling of those terrorist organizations and getting rid of the weapons in the streets of Tripoli.
If you wouldn't want Russia and Turkey to control the process, why did General Haftar go to Moscow with the aim of signing the peace deal?
Because when he was called to Paris, he went. When he was called to Italy, he went. There is no call from Washington for him to come. He will be there. Anybody would call us for peace and dismantling of those terrorist organizations and getting rid of the weapons on our homeland, we will go. But we'll see the results. If the results suit the Libyan people, then we'll sign. If they don't, then they don't meet our goals. Then we'll not.
Eldin Abdul Karim al-Shokri is a legal advisor to Libya's National Army led by General Khalifa Haftar. He spoke with me from the capital, Tripoli. And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the World Health Organization says hundreds of thousands of people will die from antimicrobial resistance because new drugs to treat drug-resistant infections are not being developed. For the UAE, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
The World Health Organization says at least 700,000 people die every year due to drug-resistant diseases, including 230,000 from multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. Last year, a UN report predicted growing antimicrobial resistance could cause 10 million deaths each year by 2050 and trigger a financial crisis. The WHO says the health threat affects everyone, but those most at risk include people whose immune system is compromised, the elderly, those undergoing chemotherapy, surgery, and organ transplants. The WHO senior advisor on antimicrobial resistance, Peter Beyer, says 50 antibiotics are in the pipeline, but the majority only have limited benefits when compared to existing antibiotics.
We are running actually out of antibiotics that are effective against these resistant bacteria. It takes about maybe 10 years to develop a new antibiotic. So if we go back to phase one, we know exactly what at best we can get over the next 10 years. And we really see that it's insufficient to counter the current threat.
Beyer says scientifically, it is very difficult to come up with truly new, innovative antibiotics. Another problem, he says, is that there is little financial incentive for pharmaceutical companies to develop a new drug. He says it is risky, it takes a lot of time and money, and the monetary returns are likely to be poor. However, he tells VOA he believes that the industry will change its position and develop new antibiotics because they also need these new drugs.
For example, if they want to sell products for chemotherapy, they really need effective antibiotics because otherwise you can't do effective chemotherapy, in particular in countries like India or Bangladesh, where infection prevention control is not that good. So I do think that industry at one point in time, they will turn around. That's our hope. And we, of course, try to convince governments to invest as well.
In the meantime, Beyer says one of the most cost-effective life-saving measures is better infection and prevention control in hospitals. Instead of inventing new drugs to treat people who get infected in hospitals, he says it makes more sense to protect them from getting infected in the first place. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Spartan Mosquito, a U.S.-based company that invented a product which eradicates mosquitoes, is teaming up with several groups in an effort to help improve mosquito control in Togo. Representatives of the groups launched a six-month pilot phase in an innovative partnership, aimed to deploy Spartan Mosquito's new ProTech Eradicator technology in the West African country at no cost to the local communities. Omar Aruna, President and CEO of Innovative Mosquito Control Incorporated, and who is also the former Beninese ambassador to the U.S., joins me live in the studio to talk to me about the six-month mosquito control program in Togo. So, Ambassador, talk to me about this program and what it entails.
Hello, Peter. Yes, Enmoco have teamed up with Spartan Mosquito, Who is basically an American leading mosquito control corporation. Mm-hmm. And Sparta Mosquito have a reputation of really being effective in controlling mosquito in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So we have team up with them and with the new technology, which is called Protec Eradicator. Mm-hmm. To eradicate mosquito. And the first phase, we're doing it in Togo on a pilot phase, which mm-hmm. is fully funded by Spartan Mosquito.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, as you know, malaria is a very deadly disease in Africa. So Togo is not different than any other African country. And the Ministry of Health in Togo have been looking for innovative ways to do things like that. So that's why the partnership was so perfect, because here is a leading government that is looking to eradicate the mosquito in their country. Here is Spartan Mosquito. We have been a leading force in controlling mosquito in the U.S. and in Moco that I have at heart to also fight that disease.
Mm. So how does it work? How will you control the mosquitoes?
Basically, it's simple. You know, the technology is based on what they call attractive toxic sugar-based bait, basically, right. Which is that we create the condition that mosquito that is can be mimic the human body, mm-hmm. and mosquito come and feed into those device, and because they feed into those device, they ingest some of the, what they call the borate, which is a naturally occurring solution,
mm-hmm.
and feed that and they rupture the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
So when Sparta Mosquito do the implementation, they, let us assume that we're in a village, for example,
mm-hmm.
and they basically try to put the device around the village. Where are the mosquitoes, instead of flying to the house, flying to all the devices to get to feed off the device and they die? That's in a simple way how I can explain that. But this technology is based on the what they call attractive toxic sugar bait.
Mm-hmm. No, but this principle appears to have been in existence for a very long time. Why isn't this being replicated across Africa?
That's a very good question. I wonder that, and that's exactly where in MOCOS decided that we need to take this thing on. But then again, you think about it, malaria is a big business. Assume that malaria is a big business, and also is few corporation or company have really fine-tuned that technology as much as Sparta Mosquito have done it lately,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it's a technology that need to be fine-tuned. The methodology need to be fine-tuned. And I think at this point, Sparta Mosquito have been successful at doing it effectively. Mm-hmm. That's probably why I think a lot of those technologies have not been applied in Africa.
Now, apart from the six-month pilot phase, what happens next in Togo? And do you have in mind of perhaps extending it to other African countries in the sub-Saharan facing the same challenges with
definitely
mosquitoes?
That's the goal of the partnership, basically. Right now, we're doing the pilot phase in Togo in a region. Once that pilot phase is successful, we scale it to the whole country.
Mm-hmm.
And based from that country, we will expand to the West African country and most likely into the rest of Africa.
So who funds this entire project? I know you initially talked about the Spartan company, Spartan Mosquito funding part, but from there, what happens next?
Well, right now, Spartan is taking on the overall financial initiative for mm-hmm. the pilot phase.
Mm-hmm.
Once this is done and is successful, then we can evaluate and see where are we take it from there, basically. But right now, Spartan is the financial partner, but the technical partner, and also the expert on that project.
Mm. So is there a possibility of training Africans to be able to handle these innovations brought by Spartan, or they just have to import the machines?
As a matter of fact, the plan is simply to provide the overall know-how and transfer the technology as we are doing the pilot phase. It's not going to be like a company coming and implement a project. No, at the get-go, the people have to appropriate that. That's why the partnership is so interesting with the government of Togo. And they have been doing such partnerships for a long time. So, no, the first thing is that the transfer of the technology is at the forefront of the overall project.
What is the expectation here? Within the next 6 months with this pilot phase, what are your expectations? What do you want to see? What are the benchmarks, if I may ask?
Basically, with the Protech mosquito eradicators, we expect that 95% of the mosquitoes should be eradicated in the area where we are deploying the technology.
Mm.
That's the expectation. And when you're talking about the region where we are is in the plateau region, which has about 47% of prevalence in malaria. We expect at the end of that pilot phase that this prevalence dip down to the lowest possible level.
Mm.
So that's the expectation for the pilot phase. But beyond the pilot phase, the goal is simple. You know, malaria have been around for so long, and we need to put a dent into the situation. So the expectation is that to some extent, like the WHO is really pushing that 2030 should be the end of malaria.
Mm. But let me ask you this. Probably it might have come into your discussions. Will some other government officials across the region or perhaps in other parts of the country be invited to participate to look at the success of what you are doing in order for them to embrace it as well?
Yes. As a matter of fact, we talk with, for example, the government of Ghana and some of the people that are at the forefront of the fight against malaria in Ghana. And we are in talk with them, and we do hope that once we have a very successful pilot in Togo, probably the next step will be in Ghana or another African country. Definitely, government are interested. They're watching it, and we hope that we will learn a lot from this initiative that we can spread around the continent.
What would you say to conservationists, including naturalists, who say that eliminating mosquitoes will create an imbalance in the ecosystem because some fish depend on the larvae and the mosquito? So you are going to create an imbalance to that. Well, what do you say to them?
But that's where the beauty of the technology come into play, because, you know, people know enough about mosquito now that know that it's not all the mosquito that transmit malaria.
Right.
So Spartan Protect Eradicator target those specific mosquito. But in the area that we are planning to really do the pilot phase, we know that Anopheles gambia is the prominent vector for malaria. Parasite in that in those area. So Protech Eradicator has a study and take into account those specificity. So nobody should worry about that. And the product that is used has less toxicity than a lipstick that a woman use in their lips.
All right. So before we go, Ambassador Haruna, what is the message here to the people of Africa in anticipation of this six-month pilot phase to fight or combat?
Basically, for me, malaria. The message is simple. We need to think out of the box. Mm. And malaria is a deadly disease for Africans. Mm. And we have to look at it from that perspective. And for me, the country, the people that we are trying to help, they're aware of what the nature of the disease is, and they're looking for solution. And we hope that at the end of this pilot, we can show that the Protect Eradicator work well, and we can start controlling the disease and the, not eliminating the disease in Africa, and control the mosquitoes.
Mm. Omar Haruna is the president and CEO of Innovative Mosquito Control Incorporated and the former Beninese ambassador to the U.S. He joined me live from here in Washington, D.C. And right now it's time for music from our African collection. You're hearing from Rima with Touch My Body. Singer follows with Balance It. Nancy Ajram featuring Khalid with Sajia Helmark. And then Ali Kiba will end it all with Mwana. Mm-hmm.
Balance it up on me. Balance it up. Bring it close and balance it up. kipi kimekukimbiza? Ona babio mamio wote wanakulilia. Mtoto peke yako nyumbani, kipi kimekukimbiza? Ona babio mamio wote wanakulilia. Ndani ya Dar es Salaam ulikuja bure tena kimwana, kimwana kujui kuchuna. Na zile lawama za wale walokuzoeza, ulikuja jana na leo tofauti sana. Tena bure yule wa jana, wale utofauti sana. Dakika mbili mbele nyuma, kichwa kinauma. Tena bure yule wa jana, wa jana leo wa jana. Dakika mbili mbele nyuma, kichwa kinauma. Oh, yeah, yeah. Ona unawatesa sana. Bado mtoto kwa mama ujayajua mengi, wende tezi na omo marejeo ngamani. Amesema sana mama, dunia tambara povu, unasali na shubiri ujana giza na nuru. We mwana, wewe mwana, mwana jeuri sana. Ulichokifata huko pata, umekosa ulivyo acha. Kwa baba yako mwana na mama yako mwana, kwa vichache ulivyo vitaka.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, producer Saida Hamdun, and our engineer for today, Desta Wandirad, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, he who is free of faults will never die. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.